So when I hand over, start fucking.
Hello.
Wait. How does that go? At least we got the fuck ups out of the way early. Oh, fuck. I stepped on the dog's ball.
From the burning mesas of the Arizona desert to the slot machine clad boardwalks of New Jersey, it's Imaginarium with Scott and Todd. I'm Scott Colbert.
And I'm the horror nerd, Todd Staruch.
And I had actually planned on mentioning this even before you talked about having a guest this week. And I think this particular piece of bullshit type stuff that we have at the beginning is somewhat appropriate because I got some notes back from my editor on the new book. And Thomas and I are not friends. Let's say that. And here's the thing about that is now when I do my editing, you know, I write my first draft and, you know, then I use Grammarly to go through it really quickly. And it's always picking out the commas and stuff like that. And so I figured, well, this time, you know, I won't have that many errors with commas, you know, until I get back, you know, my file with all of these, you know, corrections with commas. So AI and grammar Nazis need to get their shit together and work on this because I don't know what the fuck's going on anymore with commas.
Well, my daughter and I had a similar conversation the other day. She and I will both die on the hill defending the Oxford comma.
Well, I mean,
I am an Oxford comma fan and I stand by that and I will defend it.
Well, and I think Oxford commas are kind of a given, at least for me, because I'm old school. Well, yeah. Just old, but you know. It seems like it changes all the time. And I learned commas from Strunk and White's Elements of Style. And, of course, now that was written in 1936 or so. Mm. So, yeah, I'm sure, you know, things have changed in 70, 80 years.
Well, listen, man, it blew my mind when I was recently informed that a double space after a period is no longer considered the standard.
Yeah, that hasn't been for a long time since we started using keyboards.
And I'm like, shows you what I know. I mean, but I still do it. I can't break the habit, you know? And I'm not even an author per se, you know? I don't, so it's not like my volume of writing is incredible or anything. I just, old habits die hard, I suppose.
They do.
Who makes these rules anyway? A bunch of people in some star chamber somewhere. Like, let's fuck with everyone over 45 years old and tell them that they don't need the double space anymore. And let's just make them all crazy. But
on that note, this would probably be a good time to bring in our guest since he is an author.
Yes. So, it pleases me too, and I'm glad he could make it. Because, you know, you and I had discussed, you know, having on as guests a lot of our friends and colleagues from the independent world. And I have a friend who's an author and a filmmaker and who has appeared in, you know, the film that I worked on, The Theater of Terror. And I said, ooh, I haven't talked to this guy in a while. Let's have him on the show. So welcome to the Imaginarium, Mr. Mark Abbott. Mark, welcome.
Hey, thank you. I'm sitting here just laughing, listening to the two of you.
Well, it only gets worse from here. So.
No, because I'm in the middle of getting, I had a story edited recently, and the editor, I almost felt just from the way I was, the story is being, the comments that I've gotten back from the editor have turned me into a fifth grader. you would have thought I've never written anything in my life. And I'm just like, it just feels very nitpicky about certain things. And I'm just laughing because the whole thing with the commas and the, I've got semicolon problems. I've got, all I want to do is write. That's pretty much what I love to do. So when you get a lot of the smaller things sent back to you from editors, sometimes it's just like, what's the big deal? What, I mean, the story that counts really, isn't it? So.
Well, you know, that's what I've come around to thinking. It's the story that's important. No, I mean, obviously, you know, there are basics in grammar that you should follow, so the story makes sense. But at one point, you know, early in my writing career, I was one of those real sticklers that, you know, the period had to be here, you know, and colon here, semicolon there, and, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And as I get older, I just don't have time for that shit.
No, that's the point. It's really like, you know, I get these things back and I'm like, all right, fine. If that's what you need here, just take it, because I got five other stories I'm working on, and I don't really want to spend too much time harping on things that, you know, that in my opinion can simply be fixed and move on, kind of thing.
Exactly.
It makes me feel like, you know, we all had a couple of teachers or professors in our life where they never wanted to admit that an assignment that you turned in was like really good. So they would find shit to mark in red just so they could ding you on something. You know what I mean? Like, you know, the content is good, but the margins could have been a little better. And you're like, shut the fuck up.
Well, I get it. It's funny because the editor I have on my current book was actually the editor for my very first book, Barbed Wire Kisses. And she's only gotten worse over the last decade.
I'm surprised after Barbed Wire Kisses, I'm surprised she even agreed to edit anything that you wrote, Scott, I'll be honest with you.
Well, there's a reason why it was over a decade. It took her that long to get over that.
So before we delve into the interview, so you guys are both authors. So, and Mark, just so you know, Scott and I do an Oscar prediction show every year. And this year I was determined to watch all the Best Picture nominees. Mm-hmm. So yesterday I went to see American Fiction, and it is really good. I didn't know if it would be my cup of tea. Mm-hmm. But it is actually really good. I highly recommend it. I don't know if you guys know the premise of the movie, but Jeffrey Wright plays an author, African-American author, who his books are mildly popular, but they're sort of highbrow, you know, and he is disgusted by what the type of Black literature that gets consumed, you know. Mm-hmm. It's very stereotypical and crass. And this newbie writes this book called Weeze Lives in the Ghetto. And it's a wildly popular book, right? Mm-hmm. And it's all full of stereotypical language and everything. As a goof, he writes a very similar book under a pseudonym. Mm-hmm. And he thinks, there's no way, there's just no way anyone is going to publish this book. Well, guess what?
Oh, someone's wow.
Like, we'll give you $1 million for this, you know?
Oh, wow.
And then it's then the like the movie rights. Oh, we love this. We'll give you $4 million for the movie rights. And he's like, what? This is complete garbage, you know?
Wow.
And it's a combination of humor and satire. And there's some family drama with him and his family. So what I really liked was the satire of what we consume as pop culture. Mm-hmm. And also sort of like Black and white relations, but without beating you over the head with it.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was like, what white people view as typical black culture versus reality, you know, and I thought it was really good. I highly, highly recommend it, especially since you're both writers. I think it would resonate, you know, with both of you. Because yeah, there are some books I've read in my life where I'm like, how did this get published?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Todd. And I definitely going to check it out because I tell this story often. Years ago, I had written a screenplay that I was trying to shop around about two guys that witnessed a murder in the subway. One of them is an African-American kid, about probably in his 20s. And the other guy is like about 30-ish or so, white corporate guy. And I remember getting notes back from someone that said they really enjoyed the story, but they had a problem with the African-American character. And I was like, really? What seemed to, you, this was a phone call I first had. I said, well, what seems to be the problem? They said, well, I'm not sure. And keep in mind, they have not seen me. They was like, I'm not sure if you know a lot of African-American people, but he speaks very well. I was like, really? Do tell, explain to me what you mean. And it's like, well, you know, he's from New York, he's supposed to be like kind of inner city, you know, and he has like a, he doesn't have like, you don't give him that that kind of language that shows that he's from. I was like, oh, okay, I think I understand. And they actually set up a meeting with me to talk to me about this face to face. Yeah, the meeting lasted all of not even 2 minutes. Because when I arrived and they saw who it was, they were like, uh-oh. I was like, yeah. Oh. So you please explain to me how how an African American is supposed to talk. And it was like, you know, I think we misscheduled this and we'll have to cut. Yeah, I'm pretty sure you did. So it that's one of those I've kept in my pocket, my back pocket. Because again, you know, as a writer, a lot of times because you are maybe you're African American or you're Hispanic, you get people who expect this particular type of writing as opposed to something really full of like heft that people could walk away with, you know, and being a, like I write horror. So of course, you know, I right out of the gate, I get it early on in my career. I used to get the, you write horror? Like what? I can't like horror? Like black people don't like horror? What are you saying? So, I definitely want to check the film out.
Mark, I would have paid money to be a fly on the wall in that meeting. Like I would have loved to see that. And that is exactly what the movie is about. And there's a scene in the trailer of the, I don't know if you've seen the trailer for the movie, but where Jeffrey Wright and his editor or his agent are on the phone with the publisher, who's like this East Hamptons white lady. And just the dialogue back and forth, because she can't see him, mm-hmm. you know, is just hilarious, you know?
Yeah.
And then he goes, oh, I'll bet you white people in the Hamptons are going to eat this up. And she goes, we will. They will. They will. You know, it is great. And the last thing I'll say, I'll just repeat. And Mark, I wrote about this on social media. This is another one of the films where I think like people who say that there's no good films coming out of Hollywood are not watching the right films. You know,
yeah.
They go and watch the latest Saw Part 47 and go, well, that sucked. There's nothing good coming out of Hollywood. And I only have one more on the list of best picture. And I've seen 9 out of 10. I'm going to watch The Zone of Interest tonight. Mm-hmm. And so far I've enjoyed all of them. Now, not all of them are necessarily like my favorite genre or whatever, you know, we all have our taste, But man, there's some good work. There's good work in the indie world, and there's good work in the studio world. Mm-hmm. You know, just give me a good movie. I don't care who made it, you know?
Yeah. It's funny because I was talking to some friends about the things that kind of aggravate me now about this, the idea that you can't just go and enjoy a movie for the sake of enjoying it. You know, people, if I like a particular film, oh, how could you like that? It's garbage. And the director, like, what, here's, this is what I do not understand. So Zack Snyder put out this, what was, he has a movie on Netflix.
Rebel Moon.
Rebel Moon. Okay. I don't understand why people who hate Zack Snyder sit down and watch the movie to complain. That makes no sense to me, that you hate this director, you bash everything he does, but then you'll sit for 2 hours to watch the movie, to go online and go, I just watched Rebel Moon, and it was exactly the piece of garbage I thought it was going to be. Then why did you watch it? Like, why subject yourself to something if you don't like the director or you don't like those type? Like, to me, I don't understand it. And to the point which you're making, Todd, is that people, well, you know, this is the problem with Hollywood. They don't make good stuff. No, just because you're choosing to watch things that are not worth your time, just so that you could feel good about bad mouthing somebody else. And that's always kind of like, doesn't make sense to me.
Well, you know, we live in the age of social media, and we have to have a negative, comment about everything now. Otherwise, you get your social media card taken away.
Yeah. Now, Mark, you're 100%. Like, for me, the best example is when The Walking Dead was popular, mm-hmm. and people would hate watch The Walking Dead. I'm like, all right, so then why are you wasting your time? If you don't like it, you don't like it. That's cool. You're allowed to not like it. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know what happened the last episode. it's weird. People are weird. I don't know, especially on social media.
And you know, it's funny because you know my daughter now, she pretty much loves all of the same stuff I do, and during the pandemic, I had an opportunity to like literally sit down and watch the entire Star Wars saga with her. And I have a new appreciation for the entire thing, watching it with her, because she loves it just because it's Star Wars. You know, and I was like, at one point I finally said to myself, I said, you know what, that's what went wrong a while ago. I stopped looking at these films for what they were, which was just for pure enjoyment, and started criticizing them for every little nook and cranny that there was, when in fact, you know, it's science fiction, it's fantasy, it was meant to be enjoyed. And, you know, now I have a much more deeper appreciation and fondness for them than I did before I started watching them with her.
Yeah, I think there comes a point when you get into the business, so to speak, whether it's a writer or actor or director, where you start looking at things differently because you become part of the nuts and bolts of the project, and you kind of lose focus of why you're doing it in the first place, which is to tell a story and entertain people. Mm-hmm. And I think it really just kind of shifts your focus a little bit. And it's really hard to sometimes go back and just enjoy something for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Agreed. So, Mark, about you.
Yes.
How did you, just a little bit of your background, you know, how did you get started in writing and storytelling? Is that something you knew you wanted to do from an early age?
So I let's step. I'll go backwards. My father, I've always loved horror. He was the one who introduced me to horror. My mom, who is a teacher, introduced me to horror literature, mostly. And when I got into about high school, I've discovered Clive Barker. And I was like, you know what? This is what I want to do. I want to be an author. I want to be a writer. I kind of tell people oftentimes, I think it was kind of in my blood because that's what I used to get in trouble for in school. Open school night, my parents would come up and my teachers would go, oh, you know, Mark is a good student, you know, talks a little too much in class, but we have one other issue. And I remember it was my second or third grade teacher went into the drawer of her desk and pulls out this composition notebook and hands it to my father. And he's like, what is this? He goes, that's your son's novel. He's been writing that in class instead of paying attention. and he just looked at it and he's like, what? And she goes, yeah. He's like, that's all he does. He's like, he stays in that book. And over time, other teachers, English teachers, writing teachers told my parents, you know, you really should look into harnessing this. He's passionate about it. He really loves doing it. So when I got to college, I thought I wanted to go into movies. I wanted to write movies. And so I pursued that. That was when my undergraduate was for radio, television, and film. Nobody explained to me when I got out of college how difficult it was to break into the business. So I spent a lot of time, I think first few years out of school, just trying to write screenplays and find an agent and try to get it through the front door. And then I got to the point where I said, you know what? I actually could turn this into a book, and it would probably be a whole lot simpler to push a short story or a novella than it is trying to do screenplay. So I turned to writing long form and back to writing long form again. And I found I just truly enjoyed doing that and being able to flesh out a whole story rather than try to write it into like a contained piece. And funny enough, I got into storytelling because I went to a writer's retreat. I got into a competition, a writing competition, which I came in third, I believe. Yes, I came in third, and it was for a publishing deal and everything. And I got really depressed because I had started in between all of that, I had started my own publishing label. I was self-publishing my own books, but of course, I was doing it by the seat of my pants. Nobody actually taught me how to do it properly. So I made all of the critical errors and everything and judgments of being a indie writer. And it came to a point where I had to shut everything down. Nothing was working. Books weren't selling. And I was in kind of a bad headspace. And I happened to be in a bar one night and a storytelling troupe walked in. And I had never heard of this. I didn't even know this was something that people did. And I put my name in the bucket. They called me up. I started telling true stories. And it kind of, I guess you could say, the bug bit me. And I started doing that. And I got really, really good at it. So, you know, after a few years, I finally was able to kind of get some traction on my literature. And I would say for the last maybe 8 years, 8-9 years, things have been moving in a very solid direction in terms of my written work and storytelling. I've won awards for both. And Todd, as you know, I also stepped into acting a little bit. So that it kind of, you know, just being out there, putting out good work and just enjoying what I do. I mean, that's pretty much how I where I am at this point.
Hey, you're also a playwright, and that's actually how I started, was as a playwright. A couple of friends and I had a theater group out in Berkeley back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I don't know if you feel this way, but I think being a playwright made my books better. You know, my dialogue is much better because I was a playwright. Have you found that?
No, absolutely. Actually, my very first self-published novel was a play that I had written. I had been right somewhere in between trying to decide whether I was going to go back to writing books and short stories and kind of getting away from doing the screenwriting. I had written this play, which I actually wrote shortly after my father passed away. It was a way for me to get a lot of the anxieties and depression out. And because I love dialogue, I think dialogue is, you give me some really great dialogue and I think it moves the story along beautifully. Yep. And I wrote the play. I was like, all right, let me do this. And I met a couple of people that I knew who were actors. And I was like, hey, I've got this piece of work. Would you guys be interested? And we put on the play for at least a couple of years. You know, we kind of hopped around New York City with it. But when I sat down and wrote the book version of it, there were things in the book I could do that I couldn't do on stage. And I thought it made it a much, much stronger story. So yeah, I actually agree with you, Scott, on that.
So Mark, I always like to ask this question whenever we have an author or a playwright or even musician on, because I'm always curious about this. How does inspiration strike for you for a story? Do you set aside time each day where you're like, okay, I'm going to sit down and write and see what comes forth? Or is it more like you sit bolt upright in the middle of the night with an idea and you feverishly jot it down to come back to it later? I'm always very curious about the process.
It varies for me. Sometimes inspiration will come while I'm watching something else. I might be watching a movie and an idea will pop in my head. I go, ooh, I should work on that. And I'll sit down and I'll write the idea out and try and work on it later. There have been times where I have been in the middle of writing something and another idea suddenly pops in my head, and I shift gears and I go in another direction. I don't necessarily sit down in front of a computer or in front of a notebook and inspiration comes that way. It's really hard for me to do that. So it's usually either I've seen something or I run across something that I go, you know what, that would make an interesting story. Case in point, and actually one time, my wife actually inspired me to do something. We used to sit and watch the terrible movies that were on the Sci-Fi Channel.
Oh, yeah.
it was just pure fun just to sit there and laugh at the bad CGI. And one night we were sitting there and she turns to me just out of the blue and she goes, Vampsquito. I was like, what? She goes, Vampsquito, think about it. People get bit by mosquitoes and turn into vampires. And I looked at her, I was like, wait, what? Isn't that an oxymoron? Because aren't mosquitoes vampires? Nature's vampires? She said, but think about it. And I was like, okay. And she's like, oh, you could sell it to the Sci-Fi Channel too. And we joked about it. I was like, that's a cheesy idea. And it's something they probably would buy. Like we joked, it's like the Saturday Night, Lorenzo Lamas, Mosquito. You know, and it's like, what?
So, this is the channel that had Sharktopus on. Sharktopus. So, you know, I mean,
yes.
You probably could have solved that, Mark.
And literally, I was working on a completely different story late. And it came to me. I was like, wait a minute. There's actually a legitimate way that could work. And I abandoned the story I was working on. And for one straight hour, I hammered out the entire story. And I printed it and I left it in her purse. And she calls me up at work and she goes, oh, my God. She goes, you hit the nail on the head. How did you come up? And I was like, it just came to me. It doesn't. I mean, stories like that don't happen often. But that one, that particular one kind of came to me, and I ended up publishing it in one of my our most recent books.
Cool. Vampsquito.
Mansquito.
That yeah. was a movie.
That was a movie.
Was Mansquito? It really?
Yeah, Mansquito is a real movie.
Oh, holy shit.
Yep. I think Asylum made that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're pretty well known for cheesy ripoffs of other things.
Mm-hmm.
So too funny. So, Mark, you mentioned that you love horror. It's your first love. You've written a lot of horror. Yet you wrote a children's book. Etienne and the Stardust Express.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think I remember when that came out,
because
mm-hmm. you mentioned it on social media. You did a couple signings and stuff. So how did that come about?
That came about because it was a poem. It started as a poem that I wrote for a friend of ours that was their firstborn child. And we used to, whenever we were over at the house, he loved trains. And he would scooch across the floor and make like these choo-choo sounds. And I was just watching him one day just do this whole thing. And they have a family dog, and the dog would always be up underneath the kid. And it was one of those, oh, you know what would be cool if I just wrote this poem about him and his love for trains and his love for the dog. And I just sent it as a poem. I wrote it for the family and I sent it over. And their grandmother writes me back. She's like, you should make this a children's book. She's like, this would make an absolute great children's book just based on this poem. And I had a friend who's still an artist, but I was running this idea by her, and she's like, oh, would you mind if I took a crack at it? And I said, no. I said, if you want to do it, I said, I tell you what, if we can make this happen, I will pay for everything. I will get the book made. I will do all of that. And I said, I'll pay you in consignment. I will order as many copies of the book as you want, and you sell them and keep the profits from whatever you sell. So that was our arrangement. And the book, its initial, when we first did it, we had a horrible time finding a way to print it. I wanted it in landscape because that's how she drew it. And for whatever reason, every company we went to refused to do landscape. They wanted to do these kind of, you know, 8x11 type books. And I was like, I don't want to do that. This is a children's book. It's a picture book.
Yeah.
It should run landscape. And it wasn't until almost 10, 11 years later, by the time we finally were able to get it in the hands of a printing company that did it in landscape. By then, the kid, the Etienne, was now in high school. And it was like, you know, not, you know, and I brought him a copy of the book. And he's like, I love the main character. I remember just us laughing about that. And, but yeah, that was, it really wasn't, I wasn't looking to get into publishing children's books. It was literally a one and done type of thing. But I thought, you know, what the hell? You know, it was a good story. The poem had a lot of beautiful imagery in it, and I thought it was a fun project to work on.
That's cool, man. Like what the, like you said, what the hell? Stories are stories, you know? So if you have a good one and it works as a children's book, I think that's awesome. I just found it a little ironic, that's all.
Does anything
bad happen to the kid at the end?
You know, the funny thing is that I've never liked the idea of as an author, you have to be in this particular bubble that you can't. And I understand for business practices, publishers and stuff want to try to keep you in a wheelhouse because that's where the bread and butter is coming in. You know, they don't want you all over the place because, you know, they can't, it's hard to market and do all of these things. These are things I learned over time. But, you know, I always feel like if you have a really great story to tell, you shouldn't be kind of pushed into this corner where you can't experiment or do other things. You know, even Wes Craven, who is known for all of his horror, I'm trying to remember, he did a movie in the 90s about a musician. He directed a film, it wasn't Mr. Holland's Opus, but it was one of those, there was a movie in there that he did that was not horror at all. And I was like, wow, that's really.
Music of the Heart.
That's what it was. I think
what you're thinking of. Yeah, with Meryl Streep, right? The violinist. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, it's as a storyteller, as you know, I know that I have a genre that I move in. But if there's a really good story I want to tell, I like to have the freedom to be able to explore it and see where it goes.
So, Scott, when's your children's book come out?
I don't know that I have a
children's book. Dare I ask?
But he brings up a good point. Because one of the things that I've tried to do with my books, I mean, they're all under the horror umbrella for, you know, for the most part, but you know, there's, you know, a Western, there's like an adult fiction type of book, not like foreign adult fiction, but just, you know, literary fiction, I suppose you would call it. And, you know, then there's fantasy, but they all have horrific elements into it. And it drives people nuts trying to pigeonhole what my books are because they're all so very different from each other. But I do that purposely because I know I'm always going to write horror because it always slips in there. I've tried to write straight, a straight non-horror story, and horror always creeps into it. Even the play that I wrote, the first one that I wrote anyway, was non-horror, but it had ghosts in it, you know, so I can't get away from that. But I can change, you know, where it takes place or something along those lines to make it just a little bit different. But it pisses people off because they want pigeonholed specifically as this when it's not. It's this, this, and this.
Yeah, no, I get that, which is why we constantly joke, you know, me and Mark Boutros and Jeremiah and Manny, like we, a whole bunch of, and Pat Devaney, who Mark has also worked with, a whole bunch of horror people got together and made a romantic comedy. Go figure.
I mean, my second book was not horror. I did a story called The Hookie Party about two high school seniors who, their senior cut day gets canceled, so they throw a hookie party for their senior class. And it's a house party story, and everything goes wrong. Everything that could go wrong goes wrong. But it's a coming-of-age story, and it was not, there's not a horror element in there. There's nothing fantastical about it. But then after that, you know, most of the stuff that I've written has had, you know, if there's angels and demons aren't there, there's always some kind of supernatural element that that creeps in. So I'm like Scott, you know, horror is in my blood. It's going to creep in there some way, shape or form. And you know, if I can get out of that wheelhouse every once in a while, I try it in short fiction, but I don't know if I would, I don't know if I necessarily have another story in me that's not horror that I would tackle, but you never know.
I will never forget when I was in college, Stephen King was on campus and gave a talk in a Q&A session. You know, this was in the late 80s. And, you know, at the Q&A, someone raised their hand and said, "Mr. King, you know, love your work, blah, blah, blah. Why do you choose to write about such horrific things?" And I will never forget his answer. He said, "Why do you assume I have a choice?"
Yep.
And I cried myself to sleep that night thinking about that.
I love that answer.
Yeah, great answer. I think I think you pointed out to me that he has repeated that over the years, you know, when he gets asked.
He has.
Similar questions, yeah.
That's without a doubt my favorite quote from him.
Yeah.
Because as a horror writer, and Mark, I know you get this, when you say horror, people look at you like you just said, "I like to skin puppies."
Yeah. I, you know what, the funny thing is, and I tell people this all the time, I'm a member of the Horror Writers Association. You walked into the convention, you would not know that those are, like, I think people have this preconceived notion of what horror writers either are supposed to look like or how we're supposed to behave. And I'm like, we're not sitting in a room brooding all day, you know, with a candelabra going and just, you know, in misery.
I'm like, well, Scott is. I don't know about you, Mark, but
I tell them, I'm saying horror people are some of the warmest and friendliest people. We love life. It's not that we don't love beautiful things and wonderful things. It's just that the dark side of things touch us a lot more than the average person. And I tell my kids this because I teach writing for high school. I was telling them right before our break that, you know, as a writer, when you get involved with a story, because we're going to do narrative writing next quarter, I'm like, you're going to be surprised how you don't have a choice in the matter when it comes to what you write and things. A lot of times the characters, and I found this so fascinating, sometimes the characters decide what way the story is going to go, how it's going to be told. And I told them of a recent manuscript that I'm getting published, where it was a secondary character who we got to a point in the story where I was faced with having to kill him, and I didn't want to, and I was trying to find any way around killing this character. And I told the kids, I said, I saw the character clearly in my head, and he looked at me and he was like, this is what has to happen. There's no way avoiding this. You're going to have to kill me. And, yeah. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, no, that's no, not you, like anybody else. And then, but you know, and I told them, I said, I cried for like 10 minutes after I did what I did to him. And they're all looking at me like, but why would, it's just a character. And I was like, not to a writer. I was like, they're not just characters.
They're an extension of you.
Yeah. Yeah, there are. I said, writing is the one art form where you're literally creating life and you're in control of it. And, you know, sometimes a character will literally turn around and say to you, listen, I know what you want to do, but unfortunately, we're going to have to do this over here. And it's It's an interesting art form to work in. I'll say that.
Yeah, I had that issue in my first book, the main character. I didn't plan on having him die at the end, but it came to a point where it has to happen. And I really, really didn't want to do it because the character is based on my father. Mm. And he'd already died once, and I didn't want to do it to him again. That didn't seem fair. But right. In service of the story, you know, that particular character, he had to die. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having to kill him, and I was not happy about it. But
yeah.
it made the story exactly what it needed to be.
Yeah.
Guys, this all of this kind of talk fascinates me so much because I'm like I asked, you know, when I asked you the question, Mark, about inspiration, is like, how does all this come about, you know? And, you know, just pivoting real quick to acting, you know, it's like when if I'm working on my own screenplay or working, say, maybe with Tom Ryan on a screenplay or whatever, it's very much like that. And I never thought about it really until you just said it, Mark. It's like sometimes the characters dictate the way the plot is going to unfold.
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And I never really thought about it. I thought, well, I'm just writing it this way. And maybe subconsciously, I'm really not.
Yeah. Characters are, I tell people they will speak to you, you know? And I said, sometimes you don't realize that's what they're doing. You don't, you know, you don't realize. I've had stories where a character who's not supposed to be like a one and done muscles their way to the front of the line. And I'm looking at this character, like, no, go back where you're supposed to be. No. I'm this is where I need to go. And, you know, you end up rewriting the entire story or a completely different scene to just accommodate for these characters. And even like the work that I have coming out this summer, one of the editors who first read it said to me, I was trying to figure out why you were giving this one particular character who's not a main character so much time in the book until we reached that pivotal point where they reveal who they are. And I was like, oh my God, this is that what he's been up to this whole time? And I was like, yeah, I know. Cause when you first look at it, you're like, why are you, you know, by the laws of writing, you're not supposed to have this character have this much screen time. But then that's one of my pet peeves about writing and editing. It's almost like you got to give it a chance. You know, if you've already decided, you know what, you shouldn't be doing this, I'm like, just wait, let it play itself out and it'll make sense. And because I think a lot of times, even with editors, they want you to get to the point right away. They're like, well, to get this story going, you have to get from here to here, forget about the line in between. And I'm like, I just can't do that. You know, I can shorten the line a little bit, but that line has to be there. And and I always laugh about that because I'm like, I don't know how. I seriously do not understand how Tolkien got away with half of this. And Herman Melville and all of these writers who have these books that are like doorstoppers, and they're considered some of the greatest pieces of literature ever written. But let me try to write a 1,500 page tome. And you look at me like, yeah, we're not publishing this. You need chapters 4 through 8 need to go because it just, I'm like, that's part of the reason. And I'm not knocking fantasy, but that's part of the reason why I never really got into fantasy, because I think reading horror novels and stories, a lot of stuff happens very quickly. And with fantasy books, you there's a world building, you know, and I think it's fascinating. Fantasy writers fascinate me because for you to be able to create something that immense is it's amazing. I'm not of the kind of reader where I can sit there and go through four pages of description about one particular thing. But kudos to the guys that can do it. I mean, that's an amazing talent to have.
Shit, Tolkien didn't just build worlds. He created a whole other language.
Jesus.
So that people could sing songs during halfway through the book.
Well, that was the funny thing, because I remember the day my daughter asked me to read The Hobbit, which was like out of nowhere. I was like, The Hobbit? I was like, what do you know about The Hobbit? And she goes, well, one of my friends, his dad read it to him, so I want you to read it to me. And the first thing I said, okay, but I'm not doing the music. I'm not singing those songs. There's a song on like every other page. I'm like, I can't sit here and sing all of that. And just as a testament, as we hadn't left the Shire yet. And my daughter just puts her hand in the middle of the book and goes, where's the dragon? I'm like, we have to wait to get to the dragon. So we'll be a while.
That's funny.
Yeah. And The Hobbit isn't even that long of a book.
No.
It just feels it.
It's the shortest of all of his works.
Wow. So, Mark, before we run out of time, let's pivot a little bit to acting, because, you know, we worked together on Endangered, which I produced and Tom Ryan directed, and you've also been in a couple other movies, you know, I know Impervia, mm-hmm. with An Identity Check with Pat Devaney. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? You just got the acting bug one day, or did someone approach you and say, hey, Mark, I think you'd fit this role?
It was Chris Murphy. Chris had been trying to get me on the zombie show they were doing.
Zombie Hunters.
Zombie Hunters.
City of the Dead, yep.
Because Chris and I met in a Jedi fighting class.
Of course, yes.
Because why wouldn't you? We used to fight with lightsabers. And he kept saying to me, he goes, I'm working on this show. I think it's going to be really great. I'd love to have you on. And just time, I guess they were waiting for the right moment to bring me in. And it was a short, it wasn't a big role. It was just, I was playing a cop that was with, that had survived the apocalypse. And I think the character, I think the character, they were going to expand on the character before they ended the run. But Patrick said that he saw something in me just with the few little things that I did. He was like, listen, I've got this script. I'd love for you to check it out. Tell me what you think. And because there's a part in there for you. And he sent me the script and I read it and I loved it. And I think we were at the New Jersey Horror Film Festival when it was at the Showboat.
Yep. Okay.
And I go to see Patrick, and I said, "Hey, I love this script." And he was like, "Great. So would you be willing to do the part?" And I was like, "Yeah." I said, it's not a problem. The you have a cop in here. I think that's great. He goes, oh, no, I don't want you for the cop. I want you for the father. I was like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah, I want you to play the main character. And I was taken aback by it. I think I've only done bits and pieces that I actually acted in my own play, only because I could never keep an actor in that role. It was a side character in the play that I had written, and everyone who ever took that role they did one performance and they were like, well, I want a bigger role. I think this role is, and I'm like, the guy's in the show the whole time. You have to kind of improvise. So I, that was like really my first true acting thing. And then once I started working with Patrick, it just kind of, it just felt natural. It wasn't, I don't think I ever pursued acting as a career. It was not something that was on my radar. It just, I kind of fell into it. But the characters that people have given me have been so interesting and so fun that they don't really feel, it doesn't really feel like acting. It feels just like an extension of who I am. So it's just turning on a switch to find the, I guess, to find the essence of the character that they want me to play. You know, I was about to be a father when I played in the, Impervia. I've always liked the kind of villain-esque roles when I did Identity Check. And even for Endangered, first of all, I love werewolves. So the fact that you guys asked me to be in that was like a dream. Like for me, that was a dream come true. Like I couldn't wait. And then I just had a lot of fun with that, you know, just talking with Tom and just like, okay, what is it that you want me to do here? You know, how do you want me to behave kind of thing? And I just kind of took it as how, because I remember there was one part where I had my wedding ring on and Tom comes to me and he goes, you know, we were looking and I just realized you've had your wedding ring on through the whole thing. You say, and I was like, okay. And he goes, I don't know what we're going to do about this. Because, and I was like, you know what? I got it. So when I got attacked, that's why I yelled out, I got a family.
Okay.
I was like, you can't kill me. I have a family. And I think somebody off to the side was like, what? Whose wife would let him run around and do this?
Right. That's funny. That was a long time. I don't even remember. I don't even remember the wedding ring thing, but I do remember that, like, the scenes that you were in, you were off in the woods getting blood dumped on you.
Oh my god!
You know, and then we were busy setting up for that final scene where all the finale happens. So
yeah,
we kind of split the work. Tom's like, okay, we're gonna go film these scenes off in the woods where you guys are traipsing around and getting into mischief, and then we were preparing for the big finale. So yeah,
that blood was cold. My God, that's the one thing I remember, like, because I was stuck soaking wet after that because I couldn't clean up.
Right.
Because I had to, because the next shot was in the cat and the temperature dropped that night. And I was just like, man, I am freezing in this wet shirt and this jacket and everything else. But I had a blast. I thought
that was fun.
It was so much fun.
Scott, just to give you some context, this was the first time. The second time I thought my father was going to literally murder Tom Ryan. and I'm not kidding, because a lot of us got to the site. We rented this cabin down in South Jersey in the Pine Barrens that the guy had built, and he rents it out. It's a hunting cabin. So we rented it out and we only had it for one day, you know, and we got there like 8 a.m. to set up, and we shot all day late into the night. When I got in a car with my father to drive home, the sun was coming up the next day.
Mm-hmm.
So we were exhausted. So Mark is right. By the end of that shoot, I couldn't feel my feet. My back hurt. And Tom, you know, Tom is Tom. At one point, my dad looked at him and goes, this next take better be the last take. And I was like, holy shit. I was instantly 8 years old again with my dad yelling at me. You know what I mean? Like, because my dad, Mark, was a mechanic. So my entire job growing up was to hold the flashlight and get yelled at.
Oh, right? Okay.
Hold the light and get yelled at. That was my whole childhood. You know. Oh. No, but that was a fun shoot. And you know how it is, Mark. You like these indie shoots are long, grueling days.
Yeah.
But then you see the final product and you're like, that was worth it.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. It absolutely you know what I do remember, Todd? I don't know why this was so funny. When we went to the premiere and the scene at the beginning of Endangered when the creature gets you and everybody in the theater is like cheering. And I think it was at the end, you were like, I don't understand why everybody got a kick out of watching me.
Everybody loves it when I get killed in a movie, Mark. I've been killed like I think four times in movies. And it gets a big pop every time.
Oh.
Like, so in Endangered, I get killed by a werewolf. In Wrapped, Russ Hackett drives a pipe through my skull. And then Tom, in my movie, Tom shoots me in the face. I'm like, and every single time, like, people are like cheering. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, people just love it. But to your point, Mike, it is a lot of fun, you know, and doing the makeup and everything and the effects and whatnot is a lot of fun. So I did have fun. And when I saw that scene in Endangered, when I finally saw the movie, I'm like, okay, that was actually really funny.
Yeah.
All right. Well, unfortunately, we're just about out of time, Mark. So before we wrap it up, why don't you tell the listeners, you know, what you're working on next and how they can find your work and buy your books and such.
Okay. Well, I'm happy to announce that my first like outside published novel. I finally found a publisher for my new book, Sinister Ascension. That will be out in July of this year.
Nice.
So, from Mocha Memoirs Press. So I'm really excited about that coming out. If you're looking to find me, you can find me at my website at www.whoismarklabbott.com. Everything is there, my books, where I'm going to be making my next appearances. I'm usually doing storytelling around the city, so I make announcements on my Facebook page, which is also Who is Mark L. Abbott on Facebook, and Who is MLA on Instagram, if you're looking for me there.
Very cool. And one thing I will point out, because I make this mistake at least 75% of the time, it's Mark with a C.
Yes, Mark with a C, and
I do it all the time.
And Abbott, just like Abbott and Costello, two B's and two T's. So,
All right. What about you, Todd? What have you got going on?
Well, our submissions are open for Grindhouse Nights Film Festival. The submissions are rolling in, so I'm very excited about that. You can find us on Film Freeway. Just look up Grindhouse Nights Film Festival. And Scott, I know you're, you know, one of our esteemed judges again this time around. So I'm going to be watching a ton of films. Other than that, my full-time job is keeping me very, very busy. So unfortunately, the creative side, is kind of on the back burner. So, you know, you guys, I'm sure you guys know how this is. I've got like six or seven things that are about 30 to 40% done, you know, and they're just sitting there percolating. So that's really it. What about you, buddy?
Well, aside from being a judge on the Grindhouse Nights Film Fest, and I started watching the movies, and I want to say really quickly, competition is going to be stiff this year, just from the few movies that I've seen so far. They were all top notch for the most part. And it's going to be a hell of a time trying to decide things this year, because there's some really good submissions coming in. That being said, Tree of Everlasting Sorrow will be out. I'm assuming it's going to be about the beginning of April. And I will finally be glad to get that out and done. Because I'm at that point, and I think Mark, you might understand this, where it's like childbirth. Just get this fucking thing out of me.
I understand.
So that's where that's at. But in the meantime, you can pick up my other books at Amazon, and you can get the ebook versions wherever ebooks are sold. And of course, there's audible.com where you can get the three novels, I should say. And you'll have a good time listening to them.
I can attest to that. Mark, man, thanks so much for being on the show. It's great to catch up. I haven't spoken to you in a while. I'm glad you are to hear that you're doing well.
Thank you. I'm happy I was able to make it. I really am.
Fantastic. So once the book comes out, we'll definitely have you back so we can talk about it.
Sure. I'd love to.
All right. Good stuff.
All right. And until next time, may all of your journeys be filled with pure imagination.